Supreme Court of the State of Colorado has now sentenced Justice Malarkey to that.
Good afternoon. The first case up is the marriage of Roberts and Lipson. And we're ready to hear from the petitioner.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. This is Robert Lanham appearing on behalf of Petitioner Michael Roberts. As an initial matter, Your Honor, I got permission from the court clerk to pass out copies of the rule that we're considering, if I could approach the judge.
Sure.
Thank you.
I had asked the clerk if I could highlight the relevant portions of the rule. I was told I could not, so these are blank and also don't have any page numbers. This case and the two cases that follow it are basically about a single issue: whether this court intended, when it adopted Rule 16.2 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, that a trial court could reopen a property division under the five-year jurisdiction provision of 16.2E sub 10, even in a case, as in present cases, where the original divorce case was filed before the rule's effective date, which is January 1 of 2005. Real simple recitation of the facts in this case. You've probably all seen it in the briefs. Parties were married in 2001. Petitioner filed for divorce in Boulder District Court in November of 2004. And that court entered a decree in March of 2005. In between the filing of the case and the final orders, Rule 16.2 became effective on January 1 of 05. And that's sort of the blanket catch-all case that governs a lot of the aspects of the divorce case, just like its twin does in civil litigation. It has some provisions that are specific to divorces. And the really radical thing about this rule as opposed to the predecessor 26.2 was the five-year continuing jurisdiction provision for if a party alleged non-disclosure or misstatement of assets. Previously, it was governed by Rule 60B with a six-month jurisdiction.
Just remind me, and when looking at what you just passed out, the only thing we're looking at is the first page is the order, basically?
Well, after the first page is the entire rule.
Yes.
And we will be briefly looking at several provisions of that rule.
But there isn't anything about the prospective or retrospective or retroactive nature of this rule in anything in the text itself, right? It's the order of the effective date that we're looking
at? No. And actually, I will be referring the court to 16.2E, I believe. Let me check my notes right quickly. 16.2E sub 10, which is at the bottom of page 5, that does contain language that can only be interpreted in a prospective manner. I will get to that.
Okay.
So primarily it's the effective date on the first page on the corrective order and E10. But it's one of those things you need to look at the entire case to really put it together in perspective. It's hard for even family law practitioners to do that. We see it every day.
You know, counsel, since we're talking about your handout, I don't want to suggest that this case turns on a comma, but there's actually a discrepancy between the effective date clause and this order that you just handed out. And what I have in front of me, which I believe, which comes from Westlaw, and that is the distinction is whether there's a comma or not. after the first part of that clause, you know, ending January 1st, 2005, at that point preceding and for post-decree motions. I'm curious whether you've noticed that and whether we have any idea where that error code or that discrepancy code
is. Well, my recollection is this is downloaded off a judicial website. It's not something I
created. The one that's in front of us
the
now?
The one that was handed out.
Okay.
But you did just take me down memory lane a long ways back. I remember when this is in the trial court, picking up that discrepancy you just pointed out, and I have no explanation for it. As far as I know, this is an accurate copy of the rule. I once won $1 million judgment in a civil litigation case over some stolen VCRs about a warehouse over a comma. I hope this case doesn't hinge on a comma, however.
Okay.
So anyhow, very briefly,
when you were starting, you said something about the time sequence here. Could you run that again?
Yes, the divorce petition was filed in November of 2004. Final orders were entered by the court in March of 05. The effective date of 16.2 was January 1 of 05.
So the final orders was entered after?
After the effective date,
of this rule. Okay.
The basic issue that we're here about, as far as the asset, is my client owned an interest in the company that became Crocs, the funny footwear company. And it was not Crocs at the time the divorce was filed. It was disclosed in his financial affidavits as being Western Brands with a description of its estimated value. About 9 months after final orders, Crocs did a very successful IPO and before it went into the tailspin, being a pretty successful company. Wife filed a motion to reopen almost 2 years after the divorce was entered. That was filed in January of 07, claiming we didn't properly disclose the value of the Crocs stock. Trial court, we briefed that the trial court had oral argument. Trial court ruled that this case was filed before the effective date of Rule 16.2. There's no jurisdiction, finding that the heightened disclosure provisions and the five-year jurisdictional provisions were linked together. They couldn't break them apart, and to quote the court, it would be absurd to apply five-year reach back in cases that didn't also have the new heightened disclosure provision. The Court of Appeals disagreed, said it was this court's clear intent that even though this case was subject to Rule 26.2 disclosure requirements, it's also subject to the five-year continuing jurisdiction. So with that background, I'd like to go to the handout, which is the Rule 16.2. I'm sure everybody's seen the first page with the effective dates. It's critical to keep in mind this two things: for post-decree motions filed after 1-1 of 05, and for domestic relations cases filed after 1-1 of 05, because my analysis of the rule is going to track that statement. Turning to the second page, note that the title of 16.2 contemplates that it covers two basic areas: procedural issues, that is management of domestic relations cases, and the substantive part, the provisions governing duty of disclosure. Right out of the gate, it makes it clear that there's two main parts of this rule. And subsection C in that second page gives the procedural or the procedures for new cases that are filed, including status conferences and whatnot. Not really an issue here. Going to the fourth page, again, I apologize, there are numbers, but I didn't want to take the liberty of numbering something that wasn't already. Looking at subsection D towards the bottom, this is very critical. This is titled Scheduling and Case Management for Post-Decree Modification Matters. Take that back to the statement on the first page with the effective dates for post-decree motions versus cases. This is a direct reference and the only one in the entire rule referencing post-decree motions. And it's clearly a procedural provision. It says the court will review it and decide what to do with it, basically. Pure procedure. There's nothing substantive here. Now, the Court of Appeals said that the trial court's order and my view of the case made provision in the effective date regarding post-decree motions superfluous. It's not. It goes to this. It goes to sub D. That's what it's talking about. It's purely procedural. And I'd like to turn to page 5 in the bottom of the page. This is the most critical language in here, and it can really only be interpreted in a prospective manner, which really I think has only occurred to me quite recently. I never looked at this light until very recently. It's set forth in this section. It is the duty of the parties to an action for a decree of dissolution to provide full disclosure. That's forward-looking or prospective language. The parties to an action for a decree, that's a case. A case is contemplated in the effective date order and the second corrective order. It doesn't say, or a motion to reopen the property division or any other aspect of a case where a decree is already entered. It is only prospective. It doesn't even need to be inferred. It's right there. Then it goes on to say, those parties have to do a full disclosure of all assets and liabilities. The disclosure referred to in the subsection 10, contains omissions, the court shall retain jurisdiction for 5 years. It doesn't say, or the disclosure is made under the previous rule 26.2, which was repealed specifically by this order. So this is looking forward to new cases filed after 1-1 of 05. When you put together the effective date language combined with the language regarding the procedural or the procedures for post-decree cases and the language for ongoing cases under subsection 10, it's clear it can only be interpreted that the effective date of the rule applies to cases where the discovery and disclosures are made under 16.2 and the continuing jurisdiction provisions also were linked to that new heightened disclosure. So the trial court had it exactly right. Any other result would be absurd. That's the rule of construction. You don't interpret a rule to reach an absurd result. The plain meaning of the language, this has to be construed.
Well, if that is so, why isn't there a period after 2005 in the effective date clause? Why would the court tack on and for post-decree motions? Because obviously, the post-decree motion can't occur until after the case has been filed and resolved, right? So, your point is that disclosure provision is plainly applicable only to new cases filed after January 1, 2005, right?
Right.
Okay, so why doesn't the period go after 2005? What's the reason for the tag on and for post-decree motions filed on or after January 1, 2005?
The procedural provisions of Rule 16.2 apply to any case filed at any time as long as the motion is filed after 1-1 of 05. That'd be a motion to modify child support, motion to change parenting time, anything like that. All that means is that 16.2D applies to that motion, and that's why it's brought in. I don't know if that's directly
I don't know if I understood the answer.
I may not have understood the question. I apologize.
Well, isn't your point is that this rule is only effective to new cases filed after January 1, 2005?
My point is that the provisions of E sub 10, the 5-year jurisdiction provisions, are only applicable to cases filed after 1-1 of 05. The procedural provisions apply to any case, and that makes sense. I mean, you shouldn't use a procedural provision from 1950 just because that's the case was filed. That's just court management issues. That's not really going to the substance of redividing property.
So is your point that in this case, if there was some motion for modification filed, you would look to that second part of the effective date clause to determine whether this rule was applicable to that motion for modification insofar as the procedural parts of this, the scheduling and so forth.
Absolutely.
And if it was filed after that date, then even though the disclosure, the reopening would not be applicable, the procedural portions would be applicable.
Absolutely. And the court did so in this case. The trial court did. Under 16 point, I have about 20 seconds here if I could finish the answer to the question. Under 16.2B, cases filed post-decree, the rule states how the court shall deal with it, whether it shall be scheduled and resolved under subsection C or handled on the pleadings or otherwise. That's the direction of the court for this post-decree effective date. In this case, the court handled it on the pleadings. That's all that post-decree motion language means. Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Howard Bittman, counsel for Ms. Lipson, the respondent in this proceeding. Counsel, with regard to Mr. Lanham's recitation of the factual history of this case, there's one important factor that you left out. The court adopted Rule 16.2 in September of 2004. The divorce case was filed in November of 2004. The rule became effective January 1st, 2005, but what he neglected to say is that Mr. Roberts filed his disclosure, his financial affidavit, which is the subject of this case, in March of 2005, 2 months after the effective date of this rule. And the purpose of the rule, as purpose of all rules, is to, as I understand it, is largely to provide implementation for the substantive law, was to expand the rights of parties who claim to have been misled in terms of the disclosure of assets and the issuance of decree, to give them an opportunity, a longer opportunity, to bring that matter to the attention of the court. The point being that Mr. Roberts, the petitioner's financial affidavit, was filed with the court and tendered to Ms. Lipson after the effective date of this rule, where the court had made it clear that the obligations of parties were to be honest with one another. A major point that's addressed and raised by Mr. Roberts through Mr. Lanham, and that the trial court relied on, and that I think is really misleading here, is that it has been represented that this Rule 16.2, or at least the five-year reachback provision of Rule 16.2, should only apply to situations or to new cases filed after January 1st, 2005, because of, as Mr. Lanham repeatedly states, the heightened disclosure obligation of 16.2. And while it is true that 16.2 has heightened disclosure obligations, that is not what this case is about, because 16.2 requires that parties submit and exchange sworn financial statements, financial affidavits, which is exactly what his predecessor, 26.2, required. So when, as Mr. Lanham points out, in section E10 of the rule, where it says, as set forth in this section, it is the duty of parties to an action for decree of dissolution of marriage, etc., to provide full disclosure of all material assets and liabilities, and if the disclosure contains misstatements or omissions, the court shall retain jurisdiction for a period of 5 years. What the court is talking about, the disclosures that are being talked about, are the disclosures listed in the previous subsections, including subsection 6, which is the requirement of the provision of a sworn financial statement. If in this case Ms. Roberts was claiming, for example, that there was some information that was not required by 26.2, which was the rule in effect at the time this divorce was filed, that there was some disclosure that was not made, some document that Mr. Roberts had that he did not tender as part of his disclosures, and she was coming before this court or before the trial court asking that the five-year reachback provision apply, the position that Mr. Roberts, Mr. Lanham were taking would be perfectly justified, because the original 26.2 rule did not require the disclosure of anything over and above the sworn financial statement. But because the sworn financial statement that was required in 26.2 is similarly required in 16.2, we're talking about the same thing. Mr. Lanham refers in his briefs to the fact that the adoption of 16.2 is, you know, a brave new world, that the earth has changed, and maybe in some respects it has with regard to the management of these cases and the requirement of heightened disclosure. But the disclosure that is in dispute in this case is not a heightened disclosure. It is exactly what was required under the predecessor rule, which was, by virtue of comment, incorporated into the new 16.2. So what we're saying is that the disclosure of an honest financial affidavit with correct information is something that was required both in the original rule and the new rule, and as such, it is in fact something that is covered by the five-year reachback provision. This is not.
Mr. Whitman, what do you do with the language of Section 10 in that second sentence where it says, if the disclosure, which appears to be a reference to the prior sentence, it seems to me you're reading it to say, if any disclosure required by this rule or its predecessor. I mean, so what do you do with that apparent reference to the prior sentence?
Well, I'm not sure I understand it. It says, as set forth in this section, it is the duty of parties to an action for decree to provide full disclosure. Well, as set forth in this section, if you go back up to subsection 6, which is what I think it is referring to in this section, it says the sworn financial statement. And if you go back to subsection E2, the party shall, without formal discovery, provide the mandatory disclosures and set forth, which includes the completed sworn financial statement, which is exactly what was required by 26.2. Again, we're not saying that because Mr. Roberts did not provide certain material or information or documentation that's required under 16.2, but not under its predecessor, that the matter should be subject to the five-year reachback provision, but it's because the same material, the same information, the same document is required under both of these rules. It's the same requirement. It's not a brave new world with regard to the provision of an honest financial statement from the parties to one, by the parties to one another.
Mr. Boone, I mean, you're absolutely right about, I think, at least about 26.2, but I think that's irrelevant to the, because as to our case, because we really are talking about what these words mean. If we didn't have 16.2, you'd be out of luck under 60B, right? So
that's correct.
So what is it, why is this language, why does it support what you're really arguing for?
Well, I guess the ultimate argument is based on the effective date, which says, and for post-decree motions filed after January 1st, 2005, which is what we're dealing with here. This is a post-decree motion filed after January 1st, 2005. What Mr. Lanham is saying, what petitioner is saying in this case, is that that language shouldn't apply to this particular situation because this was a case that was filed before January 1st, 2005, when it was initially filed. What I'm saying is that this language in subsection 10 is in fact consistent, or can be read to be consistent, and I think is consistent with the notion that the language, the effective date language, does apply to this situation. I mean, this is a post-decree motion filed after January 1st, 2005. That's beyond dispute. What Mr. Lanham is saying is, well, that can't be what the court intended. It can't be, the court can't have intended that that effective date provision apply to post-decree motions seeking the rectification of a misrepresentation in a financial statement or required financial affidavit. And what I'm saying is, just the opposite. This language is in fact consistent with that interpretation of the effective date provision, because
if that's true, then why is, how do you answer the former Chief Justice Rivera's dissent about it being superfluous?
I think,
why is it necessary?
What I think Justice Rivera was talking about was a situation where a party was claiming that something other than the financial statement is the subject of a misrepresentation with regard to a disclosure. I mean, I think his dissent was in a different case. It was in the Shelp case, not in this case. And I think the situation in that case is somewhat different. So, when it says, as set forth in the sections, the duty of parties to provide disclosure, it doesn't say it is a duty of parties filing after January 1st, 2005 to provide disclosure. It says it's the duty of the parties to provide disclosure. If the court looks at 16.2A, the purpose and scope section, this rule shall govern case management in all district court actions under Title 14, which is what this is. I guess the point I'm getting at is that it's Mr. Lanham who's challenging the what appears to be the clear meaning of the effective date provision of this rule. And he is saying that the reading of the rule that we're putting before you is absurd and illogical, and the fact is it's not absurd or illogical at all. That Mr. Roberts filed his financial affidavit after the effective date provision. He knew that this rule was in place. Although it wasn't addressed significantly in his argument, this issue of retroactivity really doesn't make much sense either, because retroactivity is really about fairness, that somebody shouldn't have to come before a court and deal with a substantive rule that's different, or a substantive law that's different from what was in place at the time that he engaged in whatever conduct he did. This is not a situation of unfairness. This rule was adopted prior to the divorce being filed, and it was effective before the disclosure, what we claim is the misleading disclosure, was made. And so there is simply, and in light of the overall, I guess, purpose of all this, which is to provide divorced parties with an expanded opportunity to rectify misrepresentations, there seems to be nothing that is inconsistent with the reading of the effective date provision in the way that I am perceiving it.
The prior rule gave how much time to bring one of these material omission motions?
Well, the prior rule didn't have such a provision. If the court may recall, the two cases of Gavrilis and Gantz, in which the court held that Rule 60B applied in situations in divorce cases as well as in any other civil case, and so was subject to the six-month provision of Rule 60B. So in Section 10, when it says that the Rule 60B shall no longer,
right,
shall not be a bar, that's what that's talking about. But 16.2, the committee comment also says that Rule 26.2 basically, or the essential provisions are incorporated into.
But your point is a plain language reading would provide this 5 years to post-decree motions.
That's
raising this kind of an issue.
That's correct. That's what it says.
After January 1 of 2005.
That's correct. And again, there can't be any allegation of unfairness by Mr. Roberts, because this rule was in effect when he made the when he submitted the challenge financial disclosure. And again, a financial disclosure that was required both under this rule and its predecessor.
Well, your facts are convenient to that. We have other arguments where that's not the same fact pattern. So what's your argument on the more general proposition that I just asked you? Anytime you file after January 1, one of these, well, the disclosure isn't right in the first place, so we get 5 years to bring the issue up.
I'm not sure I understand.
The intent of the court to override CRCP 60 in cases plainly filed, let's say, you know, in 2003.
A four-year-old case.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. And it's all finished up, and then along comes January 2005.
Well, I guess, and I thought about this, and I guess there are two competing interests. The one interest of a party who's been defrauded or misrepresented to have that matter rectified. On the other hand, the interest of the party who may have made the misrepresentation to have the matter finalized. And the question is, which of those two competing interests is predominant? And I guess my view is that the court must have considered that when adopting the rule and deciding that the right of a party to seek to rectify a misrepresentation is superior or comes above the right of a party claiming that the matter is over and done with and they shouldn't have to deal with it again. So, I mean, you have those two competing interests, and I don't know that my position is foreclosed because the claim is based on a case that's maybe 4 years and 11 months old. So I hope that answers the question. The other point, very quickly, is that Mr. Lanham asserts that a reading of the rule in the way they were reading it is somehow inconsistent with some overall scheme, some statutory scheme, and I disagree with that completely. It seems to me, again, that the purpose of this rule was to give, I hate to use the word defrauded, because I don't think it has to be quite that strong, but parties who are the victims of misrepresentation, an opportunity to rectify the wrong that was done to them by expanding the time available to do that from 6 months to 5 years. And it does not seem to me that the reading of the effective date provision that I am making is somehow inconsistent with that overall scheme. In fact, it's consistent with it. This court made a decision. I know I've listened to some of the tapes of the hearings that were held prior to the implementation or the adoption of this rule, and some of these issues were addressed, and this court made a determination that this was, in fact, the best way to handle these matters. This issue was not specifically addressed in that hearing, as far as I can tell, but again, the language, the effective language date is clear, and there is nothing in the rule that makes the result that we're asking for absurd or illogical. It's all consistent. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank parties for your arguments. And,